Well, it's yet another beautiful day in the city of Sales, and that's our theme music from Joe Cocker called Respect Yourself on Take It From Us, Mental Health Radio on Planet FM, and I'm host Sheldon Brown, and Take It From Us is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. Today we adopt a major departure from our traditional approach to Mental Health Radio. I was at Planet FM last week and met my colleague Tim Lynch from the Green Planet Show, who introduced me to his guest for his latest show. And this guest is Molly Ireland. She's a well-being coach and a survivor from the suicide of a loved one. So today's show is an interview between Tim and Molly, a wide-ranging chat about everything from suicide, spirituality, mental health, to vulnerability and well-being. Learn from this broadcast just how important it is to be, quote, a really carved bowl, and learn from the interview what that means. Molly has launched a book recently entitled Facing the Dark, A Journey into Suicide, which is also discussed closely at the end of this broadcast. Here's Tim and Molly on the Green Planet Show, broadcast last Thursday and available on planetaudio.org.nz.
One of the things that I think is really, really a problem is that by stripping life and humanity of its essence spiritually, right? And we're so afraid, like we can't do it at school. We can't use the G-O-D word because it's a bad word now, right? And we can't use, you know, the language has been controlled. And people are not going to church. People are not looking to the old established institutions for spiritual guidance anymore in the way that they used to. And in doing that, what I think we've done is thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Unfortunately, we have stripped out the sacredness of everyday life, the sacredness of people, the core of our connection to something that's far greater and more vast than us. Whether you want to call it God, whether you want to call it the unified field of consciousness, whether you want to call it the big kahuna, as they used to do in traditional Hawaiian tribes. You know, it does not matter what you call it. The fact is we have to reach back to and think of ourselves, define ourselves in a new way. And it's not just on an individual level. We need to be able to bring the spirit back in every institution. And it doesn't mean that we are going to necessarily align with Catholicism or Christianity. It doesn't mean we have to take now on all the Buddhist and the mindfulness stuff that they're doing. It doesn't mean that we have to be and look at what Allah is all about. But they're all pointing to the same thing, is that, like you just said, we are spiritual beings, first and foremost at our core. And we just happen to be having a human experience.
In the studio this morning, I have Molly Ireland. She is from Alaska in the United States of America, and she now lives in New Zealand. And she's come to join me today to be able to tell us of her journey and also some of the challenges that the human race have, particularly around being positive, optimistic, and living their life to the fullest. And this will cover suicide as well. So, kia ora, thank you for coming into the studio this morning, Molly.
Thank you for having me.
Molly, your journey has been one of heartbreak. And I know that there are lots of mums and dads who have lost children, and there's lots of children who have lost their mums and dads as well. And in New Zealand, the land of milk and honey, has not fulfilled that dream for so many. Could you tell the audience a little bit how you came, what you did up in Alaska, and how you came to New Zealand, please?
Yes, I came to New Zealand for the first time in the 1970s when I was 12. In fact, my family, my dad was really good about getting us out of Alaska so that we could, you know, especially in the winters, because I grew up in north central Alaska, which is pretty much tundra, and during the winter is 24/7 dark. there's a lot of mental illness, as you might imagine, seasonal disorder type mental illness up in Alaska as well. But it wasn't something that my life had been really affected by. When we came to New Zealand in the 70s, that was exactly that. Land of milk and honey was really what we loved so much about New Zealand. And it just stuck with me. New Zealand just kind of, in fact, I wrote a report when I was a little girl and after that trip, and it said, I will someday live in New Zealand, even though I don't even remember writing that report. And it wasn't until we immigrated here that I actually went back and read it and went, oh, I guess our immigration papers are going to come through. And then we moved to, so I grew up, and New Zealand always stuck in my mind, but I married a man who worked in the film industry. Charlie was an incredibly talented film editor. And as soon as we got married, we moved to Los Angeles, and I became aware of some issues around his mental health. And basically, my new book, Facing the Dark, A Journey into Suicide, is really about our journey. What did we do in terms of searching for solutions? And one of the solutions we had was to remove ourselves from the film industry in L.A., and to come to New Zealand, to immigrate to New Zealand for a quieter, softer, milk and honey, more like life. Unfortunately, within 6 months of being here, my husband and my four daughters, young daughters at the time, Charlie took his own life within 6 months of being here. And it launched me on a journey of soul searching, and it launched me on the path I'm on now, currently.
Yes, yeah, heartbreaking. And Molly, what did you do and since then? How did you deal with the heartbreak and re-establishing a way to survive with your children, four children?
Yeah, well, obviously, my first concern when Charlie died was I've got to hold it all together for my four daughters. My oldest was 12, and my youngest, my twins, were 6. And I really kept going for them. And thankfully, they kept one foot moving in front of the other. And really, one of the things that I did, and I think it was just by dumb luck and instinct, was that I began to talk about our journey very honestly. I began to talk about suicide when people in the Wellington suburb where I was didn't want to hear it. In fact, I got told many times, well, I don't talk so much about it. And I still believe that my honesty and ability to just look at it straight in the eye and say, this is what happened to my family, how can I help others, was really launched us on a pathway to health. And the way that I talked to my girls about it, the way that, yeah, people came to support us in that honesty was really, really nice. And we are Catholic by upbringing. My husband was indeed Catholic, and that was to commit suicide within the Catholic faith is basically to say, well, you'll go straight to hell. So it was not something that was embraced by the Catholic Church, and I had many discussions with them for the funeral because I wanted to talk about it openly. I wanted to say, if I've lost my husband in this way, and I can talk openly and not hide it like everybody wanted to hide it at the time, then I know we can save more lives. I know we can do something differently next time. And like I said, I felt like it was sort of dumb luck that I actually just embraced it in that way. And that was the beginning of my healing. That was the beginning of a journey for me, which has taken 15 years. But yeah, I believe I'm sitting here. My girls are as strong mentally as they are today because of that first decision. Let's look at this straight in the eye. Let's not hide. Let's not lie. Let's not pretend we're strong and amazing and that we don't have any problems. Let's be who we are and let's talk about our failures, so to speak, or let's talk about our hurt in a more open way. Yeah.
New Zealanders are not really open to crying and crying in public and showing their feelings. In many cases, New Zealanders hide so much, and death is not something that New Zealanders talk about because in many ways we have become a secular country, and so when you're dead, you're dead, and so there's no life after death, or there's no spiritual connection, the soul doesn't matter now, which has to be revisited to realise that there's far more than we know, but in the meantime you had to pull it all together and make sure that you could start this new life and create a new world for yourself.
Yeah, and there was a lot of shame and stigma around mental illness. I think we're, in the last couple of years, we're starting to begin to talk about it. When we first got here to New Zealand, people just didn't want to tell their children. They didn't want to talk about it. They didn't want to deal with it. So the isolation of that period for the girls and I was really hard. We had a few really close friends who made a difference. But overall, yeah, that's one thing about New Zealand culture that we need to start really changing, and that is our ability to be vulnerable and our ability to be share that vulnerability, as Brené Brown, who's a shame researcher out of Texas, says, that we need to be able to share our hurts. We need to share them openly, and we need to ask for help. And so many Kiwis don't want to do that. So many people all around the world don't want to do that. This culture is particularly entrenched in that way. And we also need to start seeing the world in a different way in terms of who are we as human beings? What are we, right? And this biomedical approach to everything where you're just this walking, you know, physical body. We've got to start disconnecting from that and realize that our bodies are just, they're just a conduit for spirit. They are just, we are so much more, and yet we need to change fundamentally at both a personal and a civic and a collective level how we relate to ourselves as human beings, and then in turn how we relate to others.
Very true. There's an old adage that goes way back that we are spiritual beings having an earth experience. And a lot of my friends instantly know it, and they see it and they feel it. And once upon a time in New Zealand, too, that when I was a kid at school, all the forms we used to fill out, they used to ask, are we a Catholic? Are we a Presbyterian? Are we a Methodist? Are we an Anglican? Because in those days, the Christian religion had a greater impact on us. And now with science, in many ways, most scientists now have gone totally secular. They've become atheistic. Because they said, well, look, we can't find the soul, and we've looked through the Hubble telescope, and we can't see God, etc. But they don't take into account things like out-of-the-body experiences or near-death experiences. So where people actually hover over their body, say, in a hospital setting where the surgeons are working on them, or in a car crash or a major accident, they realize they're not their body. They're looking down on it. And they realise that they're far more than their physical garment, so to speak. So, yes, we have to re-examine who we are as a humanity. And it's very interesting what you say. I know a policeman who's on the beat up Queen Street, and I see him fairly regularly, and I ask him, I said, well, are we winning? And he said, oh, gosh, no, he said, we're not. And I said, well, what's the main problem? And he said, mental illness. And I think, gee, so can you expand on this for me, please, Molly?
Yeah, and since Charlie died, I've become what's called a well-being coach, or I've been passionate about finding ways to help people enrich their mental illness and make it better. And in some ways, I'm very, very grateful for this to have happened so that I can think about these issues. And one of the things that I think is really, really a problem is that by stripping life and humanity of its essence spiritually, right? And we're so afraid, like we can't do it at school. We can't use the G-O-D word because it's a bad word now, right? And we can't use, you know, the language has been controlled. And people are not going to church. People are not looking to the old established institutions for spiritual guidance anymore in the way that they used to. And in doing that, what I think we've done is thrown the baby out with the bathwater. Unfortunately, we have stripped out the sacredness of everyday life, the sacredness of people, the core of our connection to something that's far greater and more vast than us, whether you want to call it God, whether you want to call it the the unified field of consciousness, whether you want to call it the big kahuna, as they used to do in traditional Hawaiian tribes. You know, it does not matter what you call it. The fact is we have to reach back to and think of ourselves, define ourselves in a new way. And it's not just on an individual level. We need to be able to bring the spirit back in every institution. And it doesn't mean that we are going to necessarily align with Catholicism or Christianity. It doesn't mean we have to take now on all the Buddhist and the mindfulness stuff that they're doing. It doesn't mean that we have to be and look at what Allah is all about. But they're all pointing to the same thing, is that, like you just said, we are spiritual beings, first and foremost at our core. And we just happen to be having a human experience. So with this, when we've lost sight of this very fundamental thing, we've lost sight of what makes us happy, what makes us tolerant, what makes us love people, what makes us love ourselves. And it makes it really hard to see ourselves other than sticks and stones and bones and...
And blood.
And blood, yeah.
Yes, well, I know, bringing children into the world, I mean, at the moment, a lot of children are coming into the world by mistake, by accident, and a couple meet at a pub or a bar or something like that. Next minute, they've got a baby, and we've had situations all over the place where the mother might not even really know the name of that child's father. And then the father runs away. There's no commitment to the sacredness of life. And so, again, it's when we bring children into the world, there has to be a responsibility of taking care of that little being's life all the way through and allow them to have their innocence for as long as possible as well.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And one of the things that's starting to change that, you know, in the past, when women had babies out of wedlock, you know, there was this tremendous shame and judgment. Well, hopefully we've moved a little ways away from that. Having said that, it doesn't mean then, you know, you have no support, right? And that's kind of where we're at right now, where first and foremost, we must teach our children that they are sacred beings, that no matter who was the father or who was, you know, where they came out of or the circumstances of their life, no matter what color of their skin, no matter anything, they are divine beings. They are spiritual beings first. And yeah, by the way, we've got to cope in this earth school. We got to cope in earth life here, right? But we are spirit first and foremost. And I think if we could put that back at the center of everything we do, in whatever way people want to practice that, right? There's no right or wrong way. But divinity is our birthright, and we need to communicate that to our children. I have a practice, a well-being practice, which is about 80% under the age of 20. And every day I see children, young people, a lot of young adults and teens, just crying out for some sort of meaning, connection to something beyond what they see every day in front of them, what they're... And I'm really dealing with even upper, you know, because they can afford to come see me. These are people that it's not just about economics. It's about total loss of meaning and connection to something higher. We are putting our children under enormous strain and stress in terms of academic achievements. We're not empowering them in the way that we need to. And I think this has got to fundamentally shift going forward.
I'm with you there, yes. Fortunately, I'm among children a lot at the holiday park where I work. And the kids, I find them delightful because, one, they're in a park-like setting, they're on holiday, they can swim, they can climb trees, there's bush, there's wonderful walks around the rocks, etc. And often I see kids with Star Wars T-shirts, and the first thing I ask them, "Hey, brother, is the Force strong with you?" And 90% of them, you know, they raise themselves and look at me and they say, "Yes, yes, the Force is strong with me." And I say, "Yeah, I thought so, because I can see your inner candle and your inner candle's real strong. And I want you to make sure that you keep your inner candle burning for the whole of your life."
Yeah, I think that is just awesome, Tim. That's just amazing. And that's our job, to me as parents, is to keep reminding our children not only of their inner candle, but of our inner candles. And they need to see us. We need to model this. We need to model greater levels of self-love. And we need to model greater levels of vulnerability. What you were talking about initially is that we need to talk about, we can't just show kids that, oh, the world is just, we do the work and it all gets done and everybody's happy. It doesn't work like that. We actually have setbacks as adults too. We need to share our setbacks, obviously in age-appropriate ways, but to say, hey, I'm really struggling with this and I'm learning so much. So taking our own life experiences, being transparent with them age-appropriately, and then showing how we've overcome things when we have, and saying how we're disappointed if we, you know, we're okay with setbacks sometimes too. That nobody has to be perfect, and that we have the resources inside us to get through anything. And so modeling that resilience, this is one of the things I did with my girls. I'm now in the process actually of writing my second book called Depression Proofing Kids. And it's all of the things that I've learned both in losing Charlie, but also in raising my four girls after Charlie was gone. And the things that work so well are things of just presence, of holding space for children, of being there, seeing them for who they are, and not for who we necessarily want them to be, right? And to be able to just show up in the best version of ourselves every day. So to take care of ourselves enough to be able to do that. And that's really, anyway, I'm putting together learnings, and it's more, they're more like beliefs. There's certain beliefs, such as we are spiritual beings first and foremost, that then help us go on to do the hard work of living, to make courageous decisions, to be vulnerable sometimes, and to show our hurts so that we then give permission to our children to do the same thing.
I'm finding that men, New Zealand blokes in particular, lack the vocabulary to express their vulnerability. And it comes to abandonment and betrayal and even self-sabotage. These words need to be more in the lexicon so that young ones can find, yes, how I felt when Dad didn't show up or didn't support me. And they need to be able to have the vocabulary in which to express themselves adequately, because they may, just through shame, close down.
Yeah, many people don't have the vocabulary. And you're right, men often are expected from a very small age to suck it up and just to get on with things. And we need to practice, so we get good at what we practice, and we need to start talking, having these kinds of conversations. Now, there's a way to have good conversations that then we practice being vulnerable, we practice new words, we practice trying to say, okay, this feeling means that, right? There's a way to do that that's really helpful, and then there's a way to do that that's not so helpful. And one of the things I always remind my families that I work with is that you are not broken. You are perfect just the way you are, and you're having some issues, right? So I start from that spiritual, that divine core, and I remind them of that over and over again. Your children are not broken. They're struggling. Your husband's not broken. He's struggling too. And then I remind them very quickly that we, assuming the belief that we are 100% responsible for everything that happens to us. This is something that's called to live at cause in our lives. And whether or not this concept is true or not, what we know from mental health indicators and what the research shows is that if we will act at everything we do, if we will act as if everything is for our benefit, even if it doesn't feel like it or we can't see it at the time that it happens, if we can believe that everything is out there to teach us or to somehow show us some part of ourselves, then we can then from that base, that core base, then begin to talk, begin to grab the vocabulary, begin to share our vulnerabilities in better ways. But it's about setting out the whole, like the plan, so to speak, the foundation, which is you are spirit You are perfect and whole just as you are. And also, you are not a victim. You are in charge of everything if you can choose to see it that way. Now, whether philosophically this is true or not, I don't care, right? We could argue, you and I could argue all day whether or not, you know, it's really true that we are live in a you know, we have a will and that we're able to make, you know, to benefit from things in our lives. But we know if we will assume it's true, if we will live as if that is true, our mental health indicators improve drastically. So it is about sharing our feeling. It is about talking, but it's about doing it from a base that is really empowering. And we have to get some of the first, we got to get some of the building blocks in place first.
Fundamentals.
Some of the fundamentals.
Because I've met people who have gone, been in crisis, and they've come out of a, in this case, it was a suicide of a brother, and they learnt, and they said, boy, I had to go deep, but I've come out and I'm far stronger now. And their self-worth is broadened. They're more compassionate on one side, and they just have this inner strength to say, right, now I know, as a human being experiencing this, I want to do my best to be able to relate closely with my family, be part of a greater community, and in essence, grow into the light of my own true self.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what every experience has the potential to do for us if we choose to frame it like that guy did, right? So they can crack us open. I remember a lady looked at me right after Charlie died. I was in real shock. I was in a really hard place. And I went to go see someone, and she looked at me and she goes, Molly, you're the luckiest person I have ever met. And I went, what? Is this woman on drugs? What's wrong with her, right? I was like, and she goes, you are so, so lucky and gifted. And I looked at her and she says, because what happens is when we go through hard times and we come out, we carve our bowls. And you now have a very deeply carved bowl. And I love that analogy, that metaphor, because it really shows us that, yeah, hard stuff happens, but everything, if we can find enough hindsight, if we can see it in the right way, and that's a choice we make, right? We either can be victims and feel sorry for ourselves, or we can say, hey, everything that's happened to me, I didn't like it. I'm not okay with it. I would never have chosen it. And I'm hurting because of it. But at the same time, I know in some way I'm going to be able to do something with this that makes me and the world a better place.
When I've been through a crisis, and we all have them, they come out of the blue, and in many ways we grind our way through them. Fortunately, I've had friends, which is always, always so, so necessary. They say, okay, Tim, well, this happened. You know what? Get back up on your horse. And this get back up on your horse is a very profound statement, really, because we've had the fall, and we know now what we need to do is get back up and get on with our journey, realizing what has happened or integrating so that we become a more stronger, compassionate, empathic being.
Yeah, and in order to get to that place in us, we need the support, as you said, of friends, of people who can help us in the dark hours too. So we have to face the dark. We have to look at it first, and then we can reframe it. Then we can talk about that. And our goal, our job is to really face whatever hard things, and suicide is one of those issues that really, you know, especially to me, the death of a child in this way is a loss of a young life. And we have the highest youth suicide rate in the OECD, as you know. And when these parents come to me, they say, there is just no way I will ever get over it. And I understand that. And I also say to them that this is also something you need to get beyond to. And it's heartbreaking. But we don't have anything to give if we stay stuck. And that's what I believe very much, that we need to be much more open talking about youth suicide and adult suicide. People who are at risk in this way, we have to really allow them to time to face their own dark in a vulnerable way, in an honest way, without hiding it, feeling ashamed, or feeling the first thing we do is we start to blame ourselves when suicide happens. And we need to get help so that we can then turn that around into something that we can actually benefit the world with.
Sir Peter Gluckman, he was the Prime Minister's science advisor. This is in the John Key government, national government, which was in for three terms. And about, oh, maybe 9 years ago, he called attention to New Zealand's high, terrible rate of youth suicide. And yet there was a deafening silence from the media. And this morning I was just mentioning this to a person who works in mental health, and I said, well, what happened there? And he said, oh, it's too embarrassing. We are a country that's supposed to be the gemstone of our planet. From the standpoint, we've had such wonderful welfare for the last 60, 70 years, milk and honey, free and easy, and yet we've got this horrendous cloud of youth suicide. So what's going on? And he said, yes, it's something the New Zealanders just don't want to talk about. And so thank you, Molly, for bringing this into the consciousness of everybody now. And I know that friends are really important. I'm glad that we can talk about this because it's helped me too, just knowing that you've got a good core of friends.
Yeah, and we need to find on a community level, on instead of just putting the onus of mental health on each individual and say, okay, you just need to be tougher, or you need to learn that skill, or you need to do that biomedical, if something's wrong with you, right, you got to just fix it. We actually need to think as a community, how can we build as a, you know, in government and education, how can we build pockets of support where it's safe enough to share really tough stuff within the institutions itself, right? As opposed to, and I know Mike King's doing some of this work and he's doing a brilliant job, but the problem is we need to get it more mainstream. I see kids at very, very wealthy private schools often in this country, and they're trying to tackle it, but they're tackling it as if, oh, it's just those girls have that problem. We are way beyond this now. This is a societal issue. We have to look at what are the core beliefs, what are the platforms that are in place and mostly not in place in our schools, in our government, in our communities to make it okay to reach out and talk, and to what are the structures that we can use to do this. And I think that's where vastly, very quickly, if we will be honest with ourselves in this country, I'm hoping we will go there much more.
I'm speaking with Molly Ireland. She's a well-being practitioner here in Auckland, and her website is beyondthecourse.co.nz, and she's also the author of Facing the Dark, A Journey into Suicide. Well, I mean, we have a huge challenge of what's happening within the biosphere of our planet. You see, if you turn on the radio, turn on the TV, look at anything on the news, and you're just being bombarded with information that is so disconcerting that it's really such a horrible situation that's happening out there. And this erodes everyone's confidence. And I know that if you've got a 72-inch TV set and you've got infants watching the news because mum is busy cooking and dad's doing something else, then these children are taking it on, and it's so subtle, but we're taking all those images to bed at night. And this is where I can't, and I refuse a TV in my room, in my house, because we're now seeing macabre and horrendous violence on TV between, I don't know, 8:30 and 10 o'clock, I don't know. And we're taking those horrible, ghastly images to bed, and we're sleeping there, and in our dream state, all our psychological situation is being essentially eroded by this dark, dark stuff.
Yeah, and we wonder why we're afraid. We wonder why anxiety and stress levels have gone through the roof, And the research is now coming out to say that stress or anxiety in particular is a precursor often to depression. So we are scaring ourselves to death. And we, and the media, but it's the social media, our children, by the time they get to 16, you know, they're spending 7-8 hours a day on social media. And we really need to start looking at, and I know people have said this for many years, but we need to start looking at, oh my gosh, what are we going to do? No wonder everybody's so anxious, right? What can we do to better reflect the wholeness of humanity, right? Both the resilience and the strength of humanity and the empowering, uplifting, inspiring things that so many are doing. How do we show our children that in a more dedicated way, as opposed to just getting drawn by whatever TV program is on the news or whatever thing is going on? Yeah. And this is part of parenting today in this culture, is that we've got to be better able to share our what's positive and to reassure our children, because they're often very terrified.
Very much so. And last weekend, there was a number of tents at the holiday park, and they had a big, huge gazebo in the centre between the tents. And there was a table there, and there was chairs all around it. And I went over to the people, and there was, I don't know, about three couples and about seven or eight kids. And they're all in various ways of relaxing and eating and talking. And I just said, look, I just think this is so wonderful. I can see all the kids here, and, you know, half of them are just in their togs, and they were eating and drinking, and some of the kids were playing with a ball, and Mum and Dad were talking, and they were sharing. And I said, this is wonderful. This is fantastic to see so many of you all together. And I've seen far greater groups with all their tents in a big, huge sort of circle, and everyone just playing, and the kids have got their bikes, and they've got scooters, and the joy of it, and I want to use this word joy, because it's a really important expression. That I just saw these children and their mums and dads just talking together. And then there was another family, just, and they had all the grandmas there as well. And so this is what we need. And this is spontaneously, it brings out the happiness of connection.
Yeah, and it reminds me of that quote, and I'm forgetting who said it, but somebody said, basically, the opposite of play is not work. The opposite of play is depression. And so we need to play. We need to have downtime. We need to not schedule our children every hour of the day. We need to keep our children from messages and media that is terrifying and uncertain. These are just some real fundamental basic things that we need to be doing together, supporting each other. Can't just be one little family in their isolated house. We need to be reaching out and doing that more.
Yes, what I'm wanting to talk about, across New Zealand now, Molly, there are many different little towns and villages and groups of people coming together that are more alternative. And they're looking at another way of coming together, because they see what's happening in the greater picture, and they realise that what's happening is not benefiting our society, our community, and children as a whole. And I think this is important. And I've done interviews around all these communities, and you can check them out on our website, greenplanetfm.com, such as Thames and the Coromandel. There are a group of people all coming together from all walks of life, and they're looking at everything, from holistic health to homeschooling. They've got organics, they've got permaculture. They're looking at things from time banks. Now we've got them in Littleton, Project Littleton, in the South Island, is a spectacular example of people coming together. A couple of hundred of people all working together, and they've got a time bank with close on 2,000 people in that time bank. And they've got them up in Whangarei as well, and in Golden Bay, Takaka, and Nelson, and even in Raglan, they're pulling the strings together, and around Napier. People realise there that the way we're going today is not people friendly, We're looking at the circular economy. We're looking at an organic way. We're looking at holistic health and a holistic way of being.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what we're seeing now is mindfulness and all these different practices that have come out of Buddhism thousands and thousands of years ago and are really great, and they're being introduced into companies to help some of the employees deal with their huge stress levels and all the anxiety and all the job productivity that is lost as a result of that. A new Gallup poll came out, and something like in the States, something like 7 out of 10 employees in the U.S. are so stressed out that they can't perform their jobs. So businesses are really starting to look at, you know, things like mindfulness. Schools are starting to do this as well. And I think we have to, again, we just have to make sure that as we look at these things, that we're not just putting them down to a few individuals who've got issues and we can help them. We actually have to look at how do we change the model. We are not just this mechanical, you know, bones and cells and blood on sticks kind of thing, that we are actually so much more than that. And how do we put that into practice in our core beliefs every day? So when we push people in the workplace, or we push kids at school, and we go crazy competition on them and say, hey, you're not going to be successful if you don't do this. You won't pass levels NCEA level one if you don't do this. And we stress them out, both in education and in companies. We're really not treating them as a dignified, we're not trusting. And I think one of the things that we've lost, as we've lost our spiritual connection, is we've lost the ability to trust in something bigger than ourselves. The fact of the matter is we don't do it all ourselves. We are part of a whole system, but we're part of also a system that goes beyond this planet, beyond Earth, I believe. And we need to reach out, and I mean reach out both spiritually and connectedly in the community, for holism, for holistic health, as you mentioned. It goes through all levels, and there are core beliefs that support that, and there are core beliefs that are really contrary to that.
Yes, well, one of the premises for this whole program was I ask, how does a human being live on a planet? And I remember way back when I had a major shift when I was 25 years of age, I did a 180-degree shift, and it was like I had sort of stripped myself naked and says, right, how does a human being live? And then start from there. And, of course, you have to take in the air. And our planet lends us a body first. Our planet lends us a body. It lends us free air, free rainwater, and until recently, a free food chain. And so we've been gifted with the articles of life. We've been gifted. And so what do we do in reciprocity? What do we give back? And we have to start essentially with ourselves and our closest to us, our family, and build out there from the community and then into cities and towns and regions, etc. Because New Zealand was once upon a time seen as a moral compass for the world on so many levels, and that we actually had some fantastic virtues as a country that had team spirit. And team spirit has carried us on so many levels, particularly with, say, the All Blacks and the America's Cup winning that. And yet, at the moment, we still have to get out of this dip and lift our game up again. And I want to say thank you very much for bringing a lot of your input here, Molly, because well-being. Now, our government has got a well-being register or a budget, which is one of the first in the world. And I think Bhutan started it off. Well-being. Can you tell us a little bit more about how we bring about that into being?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's on so many different levels. It is physical. It is emotional. It is being able, physically taking care of ourselves first and foremost. Healthy foods, healthy planet, right? If our planet's not healthy, we cannot be healthy, vice versa. We cannot be healthy when we have an unhealthy planet. And then emotionally, we have to be able to share our hurts and be vulnerable. We have to actually say, okay, this happened to me and there is no shame, but I've learned something from it. It's also social. We have to have networks in place that support people, places, safe places that people can go when they're really hurting without judgment, right? So places that people can talk where there's no right or wrong or you should have done this or you should have done this. It's just hold space for you. I always like to say that to my families, hold space for each other. Hold space that's loving, that's forgiving, that's based on the sacredness of who you are. And then there is the spiritual side. We are fundamentally so much more than a physical or even a social body, right? We are spiritual beings who must connect to something higher, to ourselves, and keep reminding ourselves of this connection so that we can help remind other people that they are connected too. So yeah, well-being is all of these things. You cannot just take one. You can't just look at things biomedically. And they're starting to realize this now with depression. For example, after Charlie got ill, I became a real research nut. I read every study on this. Well, a huge study came out from the University of Colorado back in April of 2019. It's pretty recent. And basically, they could not find a gene for depression, even though they looked for 13 years and they researched. There's no gene for depression. And the reason is because it is all these different things that have come in. It is not just a biomedical problem. It is a social problem. It is a spiritual problem. It is a physical problem. They also now believe that even though antidepressants and pharmaceuticals can help people with mental illness, what happens is that we tend to realize now that the low brain chemicals, that's what we used to blame depression and anxiety, oh, just the chemicals are whacked out of their brain, right? It's not right. This is actually not true anymore, that we actually know that the body-mind system is such an amazing system that it's actually when we get depressed that low neurochemicals in our brain is the result of this loss of connection with everything else, not the cause of it. And this is really interesting because we just thought, oh, well, people who were depressed, they had brains that didn't pump out the right number of chemicals, so we'll just give it to them in pill form. We realize this is not true. And as much as they've tried to prove that, because obviously this is a huge pharmaceutical economic driver, but they can't prove that. And it's because depression and well-being is so much more complicated than that. And I don't mean complicated in that it has to be hard. It just means it has to be multifaceted. And whatever we do, we cannot look at it from one lens. I think the lens of spirit coming first is the only one that gets us closely to trying to solve some of this, and at least starting from that base, that we are spiritual beings having a human experience.
See, one of the things too that and it's very dicey these days, but of touch. Because I know that when I've been down and out and our friends come round, or mum and dad, or they rub your back, rub your neck, and this, and soothing words, and you actually feel, good, I'm being loved, and I trust where this love is coming from. And this too is so, so important. But now we have also got other people who have used the hug and the rubbing of the back to further their own selfish agenda. And this has got in the way hugely, hasn't it?
Yeah, it really has. I think we've pathologized just about everything now. We've pathologized touch. We've pathologized just about everything, being upset, right? Yeah, and there are people who have taken advantage of it. And when we watch those stories, when we watch those stories on TV or we hear them on social media and we hear about, we're focused in on the minority, the very small percentage of people who are doing some really bad things, right? And we're forgetting that as human beings, we need to be loved. We need to be touched in healthy and appropriate ways. And so with this, we're constantly bombarded with all these messages about that one guy who did that, or that one person who wasn't ethical or didn't live with integrity in that moment. We forget that we still lost then, that we're human and we absolutely must be touched. We must be loved. We must feel connected. in healthy, positive ways. And it skewed our perspective on humanity, right? We let these one cases, it's like when we have car accidents, you know, then the whole system then rallies around trying to prevent those car accidents. Now, I get that. We don't want car accidents. We don't want people to die of suicide. But having said that, what are we doing then to build solid systems that are preventing it in the first place? And what are we doing without throwing the baby out with the bathwater? What are we actually doing to make it easier and safe for people to love each other in healthy ways?
Yes. When I was a kid, when I was 5 years of age, I used to go to a school, country school. And we had a teacher, and her name was Vera Dawson. And what happened was that every day, she would have somebody sit on her knee and she'd go through either reading or whatever it was. And it was so wonderful because we'd broken away from mum and gone the 3 kilometres to school. And I happened to see her at the airport here in Auckland, and she was 90 years of age. And I went up to her, I said, Vera, can I just say, lovely to see you, but can I even say something even more? When I left my mummy at home, I went to school and there was another mummy at school. And we just hugged and laughed. But this was, in those days, you could do things like that. Today you can't. And this is, I think, a big blot on the system. We have become so PC on so many levels that feelings can't be expressed as closely as that.
And teachers, this is putting enormous strain on teachers. They have so many rules about what they can and cannot do. And yet, we need to be empowering these people who are dealing with our children every day. They're doing amazing work, teachers in this country, and they need to be free to be spontaneous. They need to be free. There need to be safeguards to make sure everyone's doing things ethically, but they need to be free to be spontaneous and be themselves and just show love and care. Because that's the reason they probably got into teaching to begin with. And when you get into the system, that kind of gets stripped out of you. And we're losing, and we wonder why we don't have enough teachers, and we wonder why we've got high burnouts among our teachers. You know, and that's just one little example of how it's happening all throughout society.
I agree. Singing would be a good way to start off the day for the whole class. And the teacher would be really on their game then, no? Because it opened up their heart, because if a singing does, it opens up our rib cage. And so that's a wonderful way in which we could start. But I know that they look, oh, God, I've got the syllabus. And we've got to push the syllabus down hard on the kids. And I talked to children. I said, well, what's school like? Boring. I mean, the whole government, at the government level, needs to look at what's going on. If they're having children being bored, then one, the syllabus and the teachers have to actually be brought into the public viewpoint and see what's really going on, because I only want children to be able to enjoy school. I didn't enjoy school because I had boring teachers. It was only when I left school that I realised that the university of life made me more curious than ever.
Yeah, and how can we connect the university of life more closely into the classroom? And there are some teachers that do this brilliantly every day, right, in our systems. And there's also a lot that don't know how to do that. But how do we bring that university of life, that love of learning, of just joy again, the spontaneity and everything. And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there whose minds are far better and more experienced in this than I am, but I just say we've lost that verve. We've lost that essence, that spirit, and our kids are just so balled down in expectation of fear and anxieties about the future and not being able to support themselves and all of these things that we really need to look at. How do we motivate people now? What are our, in the past it was always, you know, crack the whip, and it was either stick or carrot. And we're really looking now, well, how do we motivate people so that it's intrinsic motivation? It comes from their just love of being here and the fact that they have been loved for being here, that they are respected and they are divine. So, yeah, there's so much in that topic that I really think it's an important one. And like I said, I'm seeing kids with high levels of anxiety in my practice every day. Lots of high levels of cutting and all kinds of mental health things. Then it's incredibly alarming. And we can teach skills, right? We can teach individual skills, but we need to have a bigger conversation about this. We need to have conversations that says, why are our children committing suicide at these record levels? What is going on here? We need something that brings people together, and we have solutions that are community-based, not just individual-based. It's great to have mindfulness, and that executive and that parent getting mindfulness, they do help. But we have not, what we also think is, it's kind of a little bit like recycling. We all now recycle, right? Or we don't use plastic bags in grocery stores, so it then makes the corporations or the other people off the hook. They don't have to do anything because we're all doing it. So it becomes an individual issue. It's a collective issue, well-being. And we have to tackle it all together. And we cannot just blame that one person or this person, or she just doesn't have good coping skills, or she needs to learn that. Those are important. And I teach them every day, but they're not the all, they're not the entire answer.
See, one of the big things is that, as you say, teachers, the syllabus is expanding all the time. They haven't got much time. When I was teaching up in China, they started at 7:30 in the morning and they finished at 5 o'clock. And they went from Monday to Saturday, and Sundays was optional. I mean, here in New Zealand, unfortunately, we've got more play and more sport, which is really quite wonderful. But the children's lives, how do we get yet another course on how to have children relax and express their feelings in a safe environment to make sure that we don't have these suicides?
We have to model it. We as parents have to be relaxed. We have to learn more relaxing skills. We have to, in sport, for instance, you raise, that's a great point. It's like, we got to stop pushing our children so hard. Sports now become, for a lot of children, not fun. It's just competitive, just like school. And so we, as if we want relaxed, happy, balanced children, we have to, as adults, model those things. We have to work on ourselves first. And we have to really then live that and show children it's safe to share your feelings. It's safe to talk about things that hurt. It's safe to be who you are. It's safe to love other people and to sometimes get hurt. And it's safe to try and take risks, and it's safe to play, and it's okay to play. And in fact, we are pushing our children way, way too hard, is my experience. And I think we need to look at, how do we motivate? How do we make sure well-being becomes part of our whole community, our whole world here in New Zealand? Because it's a fabulous place to live.
Well, we're back live on Take It From Us. Yes, that was a little bit of an unusual approach to Mental Health Radio, but by coincidence, last week I did run into Tim and Molly, and it was all about mental health, and so I thought it was appropriate to rebroadcast that. It's available on planetaudio.org.nz. Just remember that Mental Health Awareness Week will take place from the 21st to the 27th of September. Again, this year, earlier than the traditional October date. So keep that in mind, 21 to 27 September. And I wish to put in a special thank you to Declan Curran, our technician, who has withdrawn from Take It From Us for a number of reasons. So thank you very much to Declan, and we wish him well with his health. And, you know, his ongoing future. We'll certainly miss him here with his technical skills and his articulate contribution to Take It From Us for some time. So thanks, Declan.
If you disrespect everybody,